This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Hello and thank you for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Ewan McElraith. With me is Helen Needham. And later in the programme, we'll be looking at spiders.
They're very apparent at this
time. Savour the moment.
I think so. Enjoy them. They're not going to do you any harm. And we really need to look after them.
Well, that's the joy of living in Scotland, because they do bite, but they're pretty harmless.
Yeah, I think this came as a result of a discussion that we were having in the office about the prevalence of spiders in our houses
at this time of year. And if you go onto our Facebook page, you'll see some photographs I took where the whole of the field is covered in gossamer. Just incredible.
Which actually provoked a question within my family, whether or not the spiders are there all the time.
Or they just come out in October.
Exactly. So we'll answer those questions a bit later.
We will answer that. But, we're making light of spiders being harmless. Many of you out there will be living in bad spider land.
Yes.
Trapdoor spiders, black death spiders, tarantulas. So we'd welcome your input on that, about what it's like to live with big scary spiders. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Now, last week, a very lively discussion took place in the Scottish Parliament about climate change. It was part of the Festival of Politics. And what they were trying to do is see how they can achieve the target set by the Parliament of a net zero carbon economy by 2045.
So a panel of experts gathered in front of an audience to give their take on things, and we'll be hearing from them throughout the podcast.
This came as a bit of a surprise to me, and I hadn't thought about it, but apparently buildings account for almost 40% of energy-related carbon dioxide emissions, according to a UN Environment report. That's taking into account things like the construction in the first place, but also what they produce, what they emit. So if we're to reach net zero carbon emissions by 2045, how can we improve the carbon footprint of the built environment?
Well, according to Anne Johnston, who works for the real estate consultancy Hollis Global, many big companies are already aware of how important this issue is. But it's the planning laws that need to change.
So where do you stand if, like many people living in Scotland, me included, you live in an old, drafty building?
If you've got a building that's 150 years old and it's still there, if you're looking at the carbon footprint of that building, on some measures it's less than a same site that's maybe had three or four different buildings on it over that 150 years. So a big part of what I do in my day job is looking at how do we measure these things and how can you compare them. You know, and sometimes those comparisons are a bit crude and they can lead to decisions that are maybe counterintuitive. So actually we need to get better at gathering data, using data, interpreting it, and using that as the basis of the decisions that we make.
I mean, there's many angles to that, but the planning process, could you reduce the carbon impact? I imagine you could pretty quickly by saying, these are the rules.
Yes, and obviously in Scotland, the Planning Act was brought forward earlier this year, and they're currently at consultation on the National Planning Framework, NPF4. And within that, there will be there is an opportunity to look at measures that you can use. And it's a bit, stick and carrot approach. What do you make people do through legislation, and where do you kind of create a framework for people to make decisions where they deliver things because they want to, basically, because it's in their interests to build buildings that are going to hit net zero carbon targets, create places that people want to go to and increase the health and well-being of the people that use them. That's the balance that has to be struck within the planning framework, is a way of, it can all be the top-down approach.
You say it's a stick, but in some ways it could be a carrot as well, because if you're a company with a public profile and you want to have a good image, you're not going to buy, you're not going to rent that building with a bad carbon footprint.
Absolutely, and that's a big issue for a lot of my clients at the moment. We're having to look at things, you know, particularly if you're a pension fund and, you know, you've got commitments to, you know, you're looking after people's money. These are the sorts of things that are starting to change in the balance of how people make decisions, because, you know, they're not just looking at the financial return now. There is, you know, increasing amounts of investor-driven action and also public perception, and, you know, those will be the things, you know, no one wants to be the person that's left with the worst performing building. They are looking for solutions now, even though there isn't a regulatory driver for it.
Would carbon reporting help with that process? You know, like, you have to submit financial audits. Mm-hmm. Should you have a carbon audit? And that would drive firms to say, very much so, I don't want that building.
Well, there is an element of that at the moment. And actually, a lot of firms are doing that, again, voluntarily. And I think that is something that you'll start to see increasingly. You know, Mark Carney, Governor of the Bank of England, said very recently that, you know, he believes mandatory carbon reporting across the board is coming, and coming very soon. And I agree with that. And I actually think it's because, you know, but by the time that happens, it'll be commonplace anyway. A lot of big businesses in particular are doing that now.
So are they ahead of the curve here in terms of, obviously it's hitting high profile in terms of rebellion and protests, whatever, but has business been quietly getting on with it and saying, actually, this is going to hit us down the road?
Yeah, I think a lot of businesses have been getting on with it. You know, there's been, you know, lots of work done. It just maybe wasn't as prominent, but it's now becoming prominent, you know. But if you went and looked on the websites of most of the, you know, the big corporates that have a presence in Scotland, you would find that they are probably already publishing ESG, environmental, social and governance reports.
Anne Johnston there, and I didn't realise that companies were so on board with it. You know, it's kind of gone quietly in the corporate world.
Well, it's interesting, if you do look at large companies' website, a lot of them now have got a section on their green policy.
Yeah, interesting. And you got some correspondence on that?
Yes, big discussions going on as part of this Festival of Politics thing. One of the things that Anne was talking about with planning law is the fact that if we want to cut the carbon emissions from the built environment, stop giving incentives for gas boilers, for example.
Yeah, that's quite a thought.
And actually, one of our listeners on the live programme Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland got in touch saying that he's confused now, because he was given some kind of incentive to install a gas boiler, and now are we potentially saying, we're not saying this is happening yet, that actually that was the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, the goalposts keep on changing.
Another one here from Twitter, at BBC Out of Doors, thermal image guy. Fabric first, all new buildings should be built to passive house standard. Not only annual heating cost of less than £150 a year, but the QA processes during construction means that you get the energy performance that was designed. I'm not quite sure what that means. If anyone does know, get in touch.
Quality something.
Assurance?
But yeah, I mean, just on that note, we can learn so much from the Scandinavians. We should take our planning officers and take them to Denmark, take them to Norway, take them to Greenland. Because I spoke to a Finnish architect, and he said the difference is we in Scandinavia start with a sealed box and control the amount of air coming in. He said, you start with a sieve and try to plug the holes,
yeah,
and you wonder why it's inefficient, cold and drafty. And we've been up in Greenland.
Yeah.
You know, it was way 20-odd below. The walls didn't seem that thin, but all the houses were toasty.
Yeah, exactly. There are ways of doing it. And what this chap mentions, passive house, which is quite common, I mean, there are people doing it in Scotland as well, but I think it's quite common around Europe, is basically you don't need any heating because of the design of the house. Things like insulation and using the air.
Yeah, it just needs to wipe the slate clean and start again. All these leaky, drafty houses with coal fires, and we wonder why our carbon footprint's so huge.
Yeah, well, please do get in touch, because we're going to be continuing this kind of discussion over the next few months. So we'd love to hear your perspective or your experience from wherever you are in the world, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
Yeah, tell us where we're going wrong. Now, going off at a slight tangent, this time of year, anecdotally, we see a massive outbreak of spiders. And as I said earlier, if you go to our Facebook page, you'll see pictures I took where the whole field is covered in gossamer. It looks almost like snow in the early morning dawn. So what's going on?
My name's John Baird. I'm a senior lecturer here at the University of Aberdeen in the zoology department.
And we're in the gardens, and you may hear children in the background because it's the school holidays, and the place, the university here, is awash with 7, 8, 10-year-olds.
It is indeed, yeah. It's really vibrant at the moment. I mean, the zoology building itself, School of Biological Sciences, is really bursting with undergraduate students and postgraduate students. But it's nice to see all these young, budding biologists in. I think most of them look about 10-year-old or under, eh?
And all going around the museum there, because it's not what we're here to talk about, but it's a great wee museum. And it's open to the public.
It is open to the public. I've been told, and I can't confirm this, that it's the fifth biggest natural history collection in the UK. And of course, the University of Aberdeen is very old, and people have been collecting samples for a very long time.
We're not here to talk about the museum, we're here to talk about spiders, because I was out the other morning, and the field was a carpet of web. The gorse and the broom was covered in web. It looked like snow. It was just amazing.
Yeah, it's the time of year for it. There's moisture in the air, it's cool in the morning. Of course, the water condenses on the spider's webs and they become extremely apparent. And spiders, you might not be able to see it, but spiders are pretty busy at this time of year and they're preparing for winter and they're kind of getting busy to lay eggs.
So they're mating at this time of year, they're looking for mates?
Yeah, this time of year, autumn, I mean, it's sort of getting late-ish or mid to late autumn, so they will start, their activity will start to die down. But yeah, they do all sorts of different things with their webs. The spiders you'll have seen were probably money spiders, and they'll be getting busy, obviously, catching prey, but also mating, and they will lay their eggs probably under some of that web to protect it from the winter.
But there can be hardly any insects that don't end up in the web, because I was astounded. The whole field was a carpet. There was nowhere where there wasn't a web.
Well, yeah, no, and a lot of insects will end up in the web, but there are a lot of insects that won't actually go across that territory, you know, aerial insects. I mean, I was out last week when it was really warm and I saw some mayflies flying about, can you believe, misnomer there. And they will, yeah, they could get tangled up in a web on the ground, but mostly they will be over the river. And so some insects, yeah, will get caught up in it, but a lot of insects can avoid it as well.
But the sheer numbers astounded me. There must be millions of them there all the time.
Well, that's a really good point. So the biomass of spiders was oftentimes really, really undervalued, or at least underestimated, it's probably a better word. We're in Cruikshank Gardens now, and if you look around, you can't really see any insects or any spiders, but the insects and the spiders are there, and a large part of the biomass, sometimes most of the biomass, certainly of the above-ground organisms, are spiders, but you just can't see them.
So are the money spiders the more common ones?
They're very common. It's a family and they're kind of generally called the money spiders. So it's the little ones that you might get crawling on you, or you see the little black ones that get caught up in your hair. Apparently the reason they're called money spiders is because they do this thing called ballooning, where they release a little strand of silk and that will get caught up in the breeze, and it used to get caught in people's hair and they thought that was kind of good luck. You know, like we started
dumb. Money coming, I'm in the luck because I was in my shed and I had about 30 on my head.
Ah, well, there you go. So, well, you're extremely... I would do the lottery this weekend for sure.
Well, take this back to basics. What is the web made of? And how do they know how to make it? There's probably not an answer for that.
Ooh, well, it's innate, so they're born with the ability to make it. It's an interesting question because the more we look at certainly insects, they can actually learn through their life. But something like spinning a web will be an innate thing, something they're born with. They've got a structure on their back end, their posterior end. It's called spinneret. They're like toothpaste tubes, and they're called spigots. And they squeeze the toothpaste tube, most of which is inside the body, and then they pull out the threads, and it's made of an amino acid called cysteine mainly, and that's what gives it its strength. And it's not the contact with the air itself that makes it kind of solidify, it's actually the pulling out of the cysteine amino acid, and it's a polymer, and that gives it its structure. So they pull on it. It's kind of like in a liquid form when it's inside the body, perhaps more like a glue. So it's liquid inside the tube, and then when it gets pulled out, that's when it's useful.
They are incredible beasts. And people are really hung up on spiders.
People are hung up on all sorts of things and they're afraid. I mean, these kind of, you might call them irrational fears. I mean, some people are afraid of buttons and all sorts of different things. The spiders we have in this country are essentially harmless. There are some reports that maybe some people have been bitten by these giant house spiders that we have. They're not really all that big, actually. I have a tendency not to believe them. They've got really small fangs. And I think it's just they look weird and people get a bit freaked out.
You probably get this every year. But I was in the office the other day and I said, oh, there's more spiders than ever this year and they're bigger.
I hear this every single year, even in the zoology department. People bring me in spiders and they... Of course, we all want to find something exotic, but actually, I have to kind of disappoint them and say, no, it's just a large house spider. And the males are out at this time of year and they're doing exactly what the money spiders are doing. They're trying to mate. They're looking for a female. I mean, I have news for people. Wherever you live, it doesn't matter if you think your house is like super clean, you've got spiders and you've got insects and they're beneath the floorboards, etc. They're there all the time, but they're very apparent at this time.
Savor the moment.
I think so. Enjoy them. They're not going to do you any harm. And I can, you know, we really need to look after them, I would say. And people should cherish this interaction with extraordinary beasties.
John Baird there from Aberdeen University's Zoological Department. Fascinating stuff, spiders.
Just yeah.
That whole construction of the web, the way they go about it. You know, the ones that put a little bit of gossamer out there and hang on the end and just go flying through the air. Incredible.
Yeah, I think we should all love and respect spiders a bit more.
Well, it really breaks down into two camps. You know, if I get a spider in the bath or whatever, I'll pick it up and put it outside.
Yeah.
But you meet so many people who hoover them up.
Not sure about that. Spiders do serve a purpose.
Yeah, I tell you, I came across a fascinating thing in Scottish mythology to a certain extent, whereas a cure for epilepsy, they used to drop a live spider down somebody's throat.
Oh, goodness.
Bizarre. But what they have discovered now, and how that can come about, I have no idea, but the venom of the spider is now used commercially in the treating of epilepsy. Because obviously you drop a spider down the throat, it's going to release venom. And it has a positive outcome for some epilepsy patients. How you discover that, I've no idea.
Wow.
Now, we've been talking about how we might achieve a net zero carbon economy by 2045 in Scotland. That's the target set by the government. And in recent years, there's been a real transformation in the energy sector, which should help reach that target.
So what's next on the list? I spoke to senior lecturer in carbon accounting at Edinburgh University, Matthew Brander.
It's transport that is now the biggest source of emissions in Scotland, and then followed by agriculture, and then things like industrial processes and emissions from buildings, like people burning gas in their gas boilers at home. So in terms of tackling the problem, really now the next priorities have got to be transportation, heat, and also agriculture, which is a very difficult one.
Looking at transport then, what do you think we need to do in order to address that?
Well, obviously one big topic that lots of people talk about is electric vehicles, and that is a huge opportunity. If you've got a low carbon grid, which Scotland increasingly does have a low carbon grid, then when you run vehicles off that low carbon electricity, they are also low carbon and you can displace petrol and diesel emissions. So that is one big opportunity within the transport sector to reduce emissions. But there are also these residual sources like aviation, which is increasing, which you can't electrify yet in the same way. And that remains a big problem.
The problem being that actually airlines are still wanting to increase their market share, aren't they? And we heard a lady today from the audience talking about the fact that Edinburgh Airport is wanting to expand. So how do you go about addressing that?
Well, that is really difficult. I mean, we talked about it earlier in the event. One possible route is to encourage people and businesses as well, who use an awful lot of business flights, to try to travel less by aeroplane. Lots of people in Edinburgh and Glasgow travel to London for business and also leisure, and there are good train services. There are alternatives. It's harder if you wouldn't need to get to New York. You don't have an option. But for travel within the UK, that is a good opportunity for reducing aviation emissions. The aviation sector has got a relatively weak position on climate change, where they've committed to offsetting any growth in emissions from next year, from 2020. But I think the sector as a whole could be pushed much further to go beyond just offsetting any growth in emissions to actually looking at what they can do to offset all of their emissions.
And that has to come from government, really, doesn't it, that pressure?
It does. I mean, at the moment, there is pressure on the aviation industry, but the scheme that they have adopted internationally is a voluntary one. And yeah, I think, you know, this is a climate crisis. There isn't time now to sort of have very weak voluntary measures. We really need to move beyond that.
The biggie, certainly for a lot of people listening to this, is land use, which you say is number three on the agenda, really. What would you suggest is a new way of looking at this, and particularly relevant in Scotland, which is there is a large agricultural industry here and we have a lot of land?
Yeah, and that is very difficult. When people talk about a net zero target, there's always recognition that there will be some emission sources that are just very, very hard to reduce to zero. And agriculture is often mentioned as one of them. So particularly the use of nitrogen-based fertilisers to achieve the productivity that we have, it's very hard to find an alternative to that. So some of those emissions from land use will probably remain and will need to be offset. And I suppose also within the land use field is the possibility to grow more trees, to have more forests which sequester carbon. So Scotland does have an opportunity to reforest and afforest lots of land and compensate for residual emissions elsewhere in the economy.
But of course many farmers would argue that forestry is such a long-term investment that actually there's nothing in it for them. How could you persuade people who are currently working the land in an agricultural sense that actually this is the right thing to do?
I think it probably comes back to government again. I think government needs to make incentives so that managing and growing forest is profitable and attractive. You could also look at schemes such as the one with the aviation sector and address both those problems at once. If you imposed on the aviation sector a requirement to offset with land-based offsets, then the financial flows would come from that sector to the land-based sector to grow more trees.
One of the other things that's been discussed is a carbon tax, and actually how businesses and even individuals could be taxed depending upon the amount of carbon that they emit in a year. So you could be weighing up the choices that you're making. Is that a distinct possibility? Is that something that is discussed in your line of work?
Yeah, it is, absolutely. I mean, for a long time now, particularly economists have pushed carbon pricing, so either taxes or cap and trade emissions trading schemes, as a very efficient way of driving the change that we need to see. And we do have some carbon taxes already in the UK. So there's a top-up tax on the European Emissions Trading Scheme within the UK, and that has been hugely successful in driving down almost to the point of reaching zero coal-fired power generation. So carbon taxes as a price signal definitely can work. Obviously, you have to be careful about fuel poverty and issues of that nature. With climate change, there are a lot of policy levers that can be pulled, and carbon taxes are definitely should be part of that mix.
One of the things that's clear from these discussions is, yes, obviously there is a sense of outrage and fear about the situation that we find ourselves in. How do you feel about it? Do you feel optimistic that actually we can rise to the challenge here in Scotland?
That's a really tough question, I think. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think maybe I'm naturally optimistic. Most people's everyday lived experience is not one of crisis. We go about our everyday business and live our lives, and you know, you look around you and things seem pretty normal. I think when you listen to the science or and read the scientific reports, that's when the, you know, the real fear can set in. You know, the science is absolutely crystal clear on the scale of the danger that we face. I don't know. I mean, sometimes I'm optimistic. I think there are some changes that have happened, like the decarbonisation of the grid, which does offer a little ray of hope that transition can happen, and it can happen quite quickly. So we're seeing developers put in bids for building wind farms where they don't seek any kind of subsidy. And I think that could be a game changer globally. I think once renewables, once wind and solar become cheaper than anything else in terms of power generation, then you don't really need governments and you don't have to worry about climate deniers like President Trump. Because if it's just the cheapest way to generate electricity, that's what will happen. So that's a glimmer of hope. But the power sector is only one source of emissions, and we need many more glimmers of hope.
That's Matthew Brander, who's a carbon accountant at Edinburgh University.
A lot to think about there.
There is a lot, actually. And we did get some correspondence in from our listeners during the live show. Talking about transport, Barbara and Stuart says, all cars should be fitted with an emissions meter on the dashboard to display to raise awareness and help change driving habits.
Well, a lot of them do that already. How are you doing? And you get a scolding from it. But if we all move to electric cars, that's not going to be a problem.
And Sandy from Blairgowrie, he said, Scotland had an extensive rail network, including many branch lines which carried freight and passengers. The fuel efficiency of rail is without question, as there is virtually no rolling resistance. So why are the Scottish Government not talking about railways and allowing local authorities to permit building on old railway lines, which will inevitably be required in the near future?
It's a good point. I mean, there's so many times you would have delightful using a train.
Yes.
If you would get it. Interesting point, during the beaching cuts, certainly in the old county of Grampian, the council bought the railways and still own a lot of the lines.
Do they really?
A lot of farmers think they own it, but the council still own the lines, so it's not insurmountable to reinstate some of the lines in Scotland.
Yeah. Well, the problem is cost, though, as
it's
well. In terms of actually travelling by trade in this country, it's pretty expensive. So, for example, I need to go to London in a couple of weeks for work purposes, and I don't want to get on a plane, so I thought I'll take the sleeper train from Aberdeenshire, and it was going to cost me almost £300 one way. So I decided not to take the sleeper train, take a normal train. But then in places in Europe, significantly cheaper to get a train.
There's something wrong there, because as you say, governments are constantly saying we need to use the train, but it's just stupid expensive, and yeah, big investment into our infrastructure, but we need to be subsidising it to the hilt. If you've got thoughts on that, you can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Now, Scotland has traditionally grown crops to either feed us or feed the livestock. But in recent years, there's a big growth in the biomass market. And Andrew Booth, who farms in Aberdeenshire, is growing grass to be turned into gas.
Andrew Booth, we farm at Foveran, Savick Farms at Foveran, just north of Aberdeen.
Well, just describe where we are at the moment.
So we're standing just in the compound of an anaerobic digester, which is also known as a concrete cow, and we're looking at four large silage clamps and four large domed buildings that produce gas.
Now, this is a noisy environment because we've got a big, massive tractor going by us now with a huge trailer and filled with grass, and they're coming in really fast.
Yeah, there should be one about every 7 minutes, I'm hoping, if we're doing it right. But yeah, so we're taking the grass from the silage field about a couple of miles away, and it's being ensiled in the clamps here that will feed the AD plant for the next 12 months.
So how big an operation is this?
So today we've probably got about 12 or 14 guys working between mowing the grass and right through to and siling it, and somebody on the weighbridge as well.
So you're growing this grass to produce energy?
Yep, it's exactly what we're doing. So instead of having an intensive livestock process on the farm, or an enterprise on the farm, this is our intensive enterprise.
So you'll store the silage till you need it?
So we store the silage until it's needed. It will then be fed into the anaerobic digester, at which point the digester will take the methane out, harvest the methane, and then the digest, which is the fertiliser, will come out the bottom, just like a cow. But the difference between the cow and this is we're getting to harvest the methane.
But one of the problems about renewable energy is the battery issue. You can only make solar when the sun shines and wind power when the wind blows. Presumably this gets round it, gives you guaranteed supply.
Yeah, so because we're able to ensile the product and have it for 12 months, we're guaranteed that we're going to produce gas 365 days of the year. That then allows the wholesale price of the gas to be probably worth a little bit more than the wholesale price of electricity produced from wind, because, like you're saying, you're able to supply it every day of the year.
This is a big leap from Aberdeen Angus. It must have been a major decision.
It was a big decision. It has been a big decision, but it was one wasn't taken lightly, but one that we're really excited about. We're in the early days. We're still in the learning process of how to grow grass properly, and it's changed our rotations. It's really quite an exciting process in terms of the farm, in terms of the land, the soil health. We're getting digest back in the land, you know, allowing us to get that back into the ground, and then changing our rotation. We've now got, you know, some fields with maybe a 7 or 8 year rotation in, because we've different choices of crops now.
So it's allowed you to go back to the traditional way?
Yes, definitely. In some elements there's tradition, in other elements it's, you know, the most up-to-date technology is farming this.
What's it done financially for you?
What it's done is secured a large 60% of the land that we farm is dedicated to this process.
There's another tractor coming past.
Make it a bit noise. Blue ones make a bit more noise.
Yeah, you're saying 60%?
So, yes, so 60% of our land is dedicated to producing crops for the energy plant here. So that is basically within reason as a guaranteed income. And the rest, the other 40%, we're playing the commodity. So we're de-risking our business.
Most farmers would bite your arm off to get 60% guaranteed income.
Yeah, there's a guaranteed to a point, but yes, but that's a market we've gone out and looked. We looked at different enterprises, and this is one that we felt fitted our system the best.
There's a lot of positives here, but it's also been criticised heavily because you're taking land and using it for energy when you could be producing food.
Yeah, I know about the criticism firsthand, but the amount of land, arable land, that is dedicated to producing for ADs in Scotland, AD plants in Scotland, is about 1%, and that's not having the knock-on effect that some of the messages that we're getting.
And I suppose we're surrounded by fields of barley going into whiskey. It's not an essential product.
It's not. We've got, you know, we want to produce food, we want to produce energy, and we want to produce luxury items, and everyone has to do what they need to do for their own business.
What about Brexit? Obviously very much in the news at the moment, and there's serious concerns that, say, a trade deal with America would result in cheap beef coming in, beef which we couldn't compete against. Could this be a solution for that, producing another income stream?
I think that's exactly what it's doing for us. It's giving us another choice within our business enterprise and not having all our eggs in one basket. So for us, it fits for us, and looking forward to the future.
What about employment? Because we mentioned the tractors come in every couple of minutes, and you've got guys rolling grass up and a massive silage put up there. There's a lot going on.
Yeah, there's a lot going on, and you know, we've got a really, really good team of both our full-time guys, our seasonal guys, and our subcontractors who come in during harvest. And that's something we want to keep developing on, and we want to develop the guys that work here. One of the guys you met earlier on, he's going away to New Zealand for the winter and experience a New Zealand winter, and he may or may not return. But that's what we want to try and encourage. We want the guys to better themselves.
It's just growable as an industry.
Oh, very much so. I think everything, you know, there's an opportunity for everybody. And I think we, although we're growing rye, triticale and grass and putting FYM into the mix just now, who says in 5 years' time we might not be putting something else? But it'll always be an ag-based product.
So you just need to convert your tractors to methane and you're self-contained.
Yeah, that would be really exciting. I'm looking forward to that. I think that's a step change. We monitor every litre of diesel that we're using on this plant in terms of harvesting, to the point that if you use too much or have got a heavy foot hauling silage, you don't get asked back again. But if we can turn that into a methane tractor, then that's a step change.
Farmer Andrew Booth there and his ideas for a methane-produced tractor. And regardless of where you stand in it, it was an incredibly well-choreographed thing getting all those hundreds of tonnes of grass into the biodigester.
We did get, again, a bit of reaction to this story as well when we were doing the live programme. Anna says, what is the impact on the land and wildlife, etc., growing grass? And it seems a particular type of grass and all the many cuts needed throughout the year to supply the digestion plant.
Well, on that very point, I can go back to the spiders piece that we did. Because if you go out on an ordinary day, you don't see anything. You go out in that morning when the dew is really heavy, the whole field was covered with webs. There must be millions of spiders out there. And there was a farmer got in touch to say it just shows you how much biomass there is in terms of wildlife and certainly insect life in a field.
Yeah.
So, yeah, lots of things.
Another one here from Dick. Grass gas makes economic sense, but how much fossil fuel is needed per unit of methane?
These are very good questions, and you can email your answers to outofdoors at bbc.co.uk.
Because we don't know the answers. And Andy and Elgin got in touch and said, the answer to our environmental problem and the elephant in the room is less people. To function with a lower population, we need to move workers from the overblown service sector to essential jobs.
Yeah, interesting points. Yeah.
It's not the first time I've heard that, but it's quite a controversial thing to raise, I think.
Yeah, but there's no doubt many folk are really worried about the impact of climate change on the planet and our way of life, including young folk.
Just look at the global prominence of Swedish campaigner Greta Thunberg and the climate strikes movement that she's provoked. Others find it off-putting, this sense of fear and outrage.
Well, when we went along to the recent event on the topic at the Festival of Politics in Edinburgh, there was a discernible sense of optimism amongst the panellists.
One person who's very much looking forward to a low-carbon future is Katrina Patterson, who is on the board of the 2050 Climate Group, a charity aimed at empowering young people in Scotland to take climate action. I asked her how she went about changing her personal habits to reduce her carbon footprint.
When I was very young, you know, I helped my dad do the composting and that kind of thing. But it wasn't until I did my own carbon footprint that I truly understood the impact that my travel, my diet and what I was buying was having on our world and all the climate justice intersections that come in with that. So now I only travel by train when I'm going to Europe. I have become a vegetarian. I'm wearing vegan shoes as we speak. And I also stopped buying clothes for a year.
And how does that actually affect your carbon footprint then? Have you gauged it recently?
So I go through looking at what my carbon footprint is every so often. I think the biggest thing is through travel. So aviation emissions are the biggest contributing factor for individuals in particular. So that massively cut it out. And I think one of the things that it also made me do was start talking about it to other people. I think the second biggest thing that you can do is share about climate change and make other people also take action in their own lives.
The discussion this evening was based on the concept of reaching a net zero carbon economy by 2045. What would you say, from your perspective, are the key changes that are required to achieve that here in Scotland?
Transport is a massive thing. Decarbonising our heat, thinking about the businesses that we have and the kind of new green growth that we're talking about, but also decoupling economic growth from environmental impact. So I think every sector of society has a role to play, whether that's in terms of how they use resources, where they go, who they talk to, who they work with.
There's quite a major paradigm shift required, particularly from government and businesses. How can someone in your position go about influencing that?
That's a great question, and something that we work on quite a lot at 2050 Climate Group, because I think working with 18 to 35-year-olds, there's a real sense of a lack of agency, or you can't really change things. And what one of the things we try and do is make people braver about talking to the businesses that they interact with, the organisations that are part of, the institutions they interact with, and ultimately the elected representatives who are there to share their vision about what they want to happen before 2045.
And do you get the sense that there is open-mindedness that and actually the potential for real action on this?
Definitely, and I think I've seen a change massively in the last 6 to 12 months. 2050 Climate Group has been around informally since 2014 and more formally as a charity since 2017. And in that time, the number of people that we're working with, the number of organisations that are interested in working with young people on climate action has exploded. I feel so lucky to be in Scotland right now and also looking forward towards COP26 in Glasgow.
And actually, the whole thing about young people, are you finding that this issue is really capturing the imaginations and the hearts of young people in Scotland?
Oh, definitely. I think it's the thing which really dominates discussion. And I think one of the things that came out in the recent Scottish household survey is that 65% of the population think that climate change is an immediate and urgent problem. And I would say that's probably much higher amongst young people. We're going to be the ones living in the future. And so it's really important that we're able to be the decision makers about what happens now.
Can you project forward then? Because people are worried, and there's been a lot of discussion about this evening, and I've also been listening to lots of podcasts and things about that dichotomy between outrage and optimism. Mm-hmm. Project forward then. How are we going to be living potentially in, say, 20, 25 years' time?
I think the society that we're going to be living in is going to be radically different. I think on a physical scale, we'll be talking about active travel being the predominant mode of transport for most people. We'll be talking about institutions where we are returning the glasses and the plastic that we're using as part of kind of everyday processes. I think we'll also be talking about civic democracy being a lot more stringent, because having gone through this transformation to a more sustainable Scotland, we'll all have had to be a lot more engaged with the processes that are defining the systems in which we work.
So actually, we could be working more closely as communities on a sort of micro scale.
Definitely. And also thinking about how we adapt to the impacts of climate change, which we know are already going to happen, regardless of our transition to net zero or not. It's going to be happening at a regional scale. Space and place is going to become more and more important.
One thing that occurs to me, and is clearly part of the discussion, is that it actually is about a total remodelling of our approach to almost everything, the way that we live, the way that our society functions.
And isn't that the most exciting opportunity you've ever had?
That's Katrina Patterson of the 2050 Climate Group. And Karen from Shetland got in touch and says, James Wong, the ethnobotanist, said that 12 square metres of moss takes up as much CO2 as 275 trees.
Well,
think of the energy and resources that could be saved if folks stopped this obsessive lawn manicuring and moss killing, let a bit of the gardens be natural for wildlife, and we'd have quieter, more restful weekends too.
There is a lot of money going into peat bog restoration.
Yeah, that's a biggie.
Which is a great thing for moss as well. To bring them back is a really big carbon sink. Now, earlier this week, locations around the UK were filled with birdsong as part of the RSPB's Let Nature Sing Day. Laura Guthrie went along to one of the events to speak to the RSPB Membership Development Officer, Will Brown.
We're in the foyer of the V&A Museum in Dundee. It's quite a spectacular building, so I'm quite lucky to be here today.
And keen-eared listeners might be able to hear in the background a little bit of bird song. You haven't let birds loose in the V&A today. Explain what's going on.
Yes, no, there's no birds in here, just the bird song that's playing due to our Let Nature Sing Day, which is happening, which they've kindly joined in as one of over 150 locations throughout Scotland, which are playing bird song today, as well as local communities. And it's all with our big Let Nature Sing campaign.
And you had quite a big success earlier in the year in May with a single that did really, really well. People are obviously keen to hear bird song.
Yes, that went really well. So our Let Nature Sing single was just over 2 minutes of birdsong, actually reached number 2 in the charts in Scotland and in the top 20 in the whole of UK. And I think that really shows how much people actually do want to listen to birdsong, and it's the whole point of our campaign is to get and bring birdsong back into people's lives.
You're set up here with a lovely wee stall at the V&A. Tell me a bit about how the day's going to go for you.
So today I've got my stand. I'm going to be talking to people about the Let Nature Sing campaign, and then also about the work we're doing as the RSPB and how we're actually the point of bringing birdsong to people's lives, and how that links in with our nature recovery campaign, which we're going on at the moment. So it's really all about getting more awareness of our wildlife and conservation.
And the RSPB did a bit of research. What did it show?
Yes, so we did some research a month ago, just talking to the general public and getting their opinion on nature conservation and wildlife. And it showed that actually addressing climate change is one of the most important issues to the general public today. And actually, in the top 3 issues, we asked them about what's happening in a society at the moment. We found that actually 45% of the general public thought that health was most important, but actually just below that, 42% thought that climate change and the environment was most important to them. And then what we want to do is then say this is important issues they need to bring to our governing bodies so that actually they can make a real difference in the future. And actually, when asked about what people think the health of nature, actually they do realise that just under two-thirds of everyone that was asked in this survey thought that nature wasn't doing well, which is quite frightening really. It is true, and that's what we've found, but actually for people to think this as well is actually what we're really trying to do now, is build on this awareness that actually our wildlife isn't doing well and actually we need to do something about it.
So people are aware that nature needs help. How good are they at identifying birdsong?
Obviously, the whole point of our single that came out was lots of our birds, which are actually in quite sharp declines. So that included our swifts, our swallows, our cuckoos, and some iconic birdsong that lots of people do recognise. And I always like to ask people, when was actually the last time you heard a cuckoo? Which is a distinctive call, but they've actually had a 65% decline in the last 40 years. So it's something that actually lots of our song that people may not actually recognise simply because they're not hearing it anymore.
You're playing this today in the V&A, and what kind of birds can people hear?
It can really vary depending on our birdsong soundtrack is actually from different landscapes. I can hear a wood pigeon just now. Actually, it can be lots of different birds. It's all Scottish and UK species which are actually calling throughout the UK. It can be from robins to blackbirds to then our swallows, our swifts, our starlings. So it's quite amazing to get this variety of birdsong that we do have.
Do all birds make a song?
Most do, yes. Some will actually make some funny calls as well. So lots of our, well, some of our species are in the sharpest declines, are actually our seabirds. And actually they'll call to each other to identify whether they're in their nests, actually if they're there, actually when they communicate. Now my favourite is actually a puffin, which then actually makes a sound a little similar to a cow mooing. This is quite, I'm not going to impersonate it now.
Oh, go on.
you have to find a puffin to do
that.
To find it
on the track. So although it's maybe not a song, they're obviously making calls, so they are making a noise,
And the key is, this is how these species communicate. So the song is obviously in spring, is so they can actually identify other individuals, so they can find a mate. And actually at this time of year, there's lots of robins calling, and that's because they're very territorial. So it's a key sensory path that they actually use as a species. And what we found with reduction in birdsong is partly because of lots of declines in our bird species at the moment, but also because as humans, we're producing a lot more noise into our atmosphere and into the general surroundings. And there's been lots of research actually showing that the increase in anthropogenic noise is increasing, and that's actually affecting how birds can communicate.
What kind of things could people in, you know, urban and rural areas be doing in their gardens maybe to help encourage birds and other wildlife?
So the key I always think is think from the bottom up. So obviously birds are just part of the ecosystem we have in our gardens, so that's actually the RSVB, our big campaign is giving nature a home, and I always like to think that's from the insects up. So build a wildflower meadow, put up a bug hotel, and actually then think about how, if you're feeding the birds, if it's the right type of feed at the right time of year, maybe that's fat balls now coming into winter, crushed peanuts in a feeder, and then actually thinking about in spring, this is a perfect time of year where you can clean your bird box out for birds coming to the garden. And it's all thinking about actually as nature, we're part of nature and not something separate.
This is Thursday that we are here, this is your big day, people can hear the bird song, but if they're listening to the programme on Saturday morning, they can still find the bird song if they want to have a listen, can't they?
Yes, of course. So we've actually now got our live bird song where you can stream from our website. We've also got our Let Nature Sing RSVB radio app, which you can actually listen to the bird song at any time. You can also find it in lots of other streaming services as well. So it's actually what we're really trying to encourage is that bird song is a really nice thing you can listen to throughout the day, maybe if you're working, and actually can be really good for your production and productivity. And actually maybe that will reduce people's stress levels. There's been lots of research showing how good birdsong is for people's mental health. And actually we did a project in Shetland recently where we're actually working with the NHS, where we're actually prescribing birdsong and actually being out in nature from GP surgeries to people that are actually having a few issues. So it's quite amazing, and actually has proven that it really is good for our well-being.
Will Brown talking to Laura Guthrie there, and we do this programme outside, and at this time of year it's pitch dark, so we get the dawn chorus. And it is lovely in a dark, cold October morning to hear the first the robin kick in, and then the blackbirds, and then the herring gulls.
Yeah. We got a text from Leslie in Edinburgh. She says, for years I used to have a cassette of birdsong in the car, which my toddler nephew used to prefer to all other types of music, demanding the birdie tape each time he got in the car. Now he's 32, yet remembers it fondly. There's nothing like it to gladden the heart.
I was out recording Tawny Owls in Lochgarten Forest the other week, and it's just great, standing in the dark, listening to the owls calling to each other. It's just, there's something magical about it.
I think it's that awareness of other life, the fact that all these creatures are existing around us and they're going about their business.
Watching down on us as we speak.
Yes.
Well, we're going to leave you with the sounds of the RSPB Birdsong Radio. Thank you for downloading us, and enjoy the birds.